Well, it's not a short agenda. It should be enough for an hour, depending also how talkative we'll be. And we're taking it seriously, documenting some of the outcomes. So I'll take a few minutes talking about the activities and the people involved and some of the lasting cooperation that is a result of this project. And then some of the outcomes, I've called it a head start because we actually begun on that before we had the money from this project, a book, Danish Literature as World Literature, which lived very much up to the intended purpose of mapping literary influence and combining qualitative and quantitative approaches. Then Christopher will present the CLEAR resource of a Scandinavian text with accompanying tools, and he will go on to take us a little bit deeper into dynamic sentiment analysis, which we have last year in at UCLA tried on a fairly large Danish vocabulary, corpus of text. And being from Scandinavia, and that also being part of the project, to see what differs when you apply methods to the Nordic countries. Tim will take us into some of the problems and challenges, but also the interesting solutions that you come up with when working across these related, but certainly not similar languages. And finally, I'll present some preliminary results from the Textual Geographies project that is directed by Matthew Wilkins, who has been part of the project, where we investigated how Scandinavian locations or Nordic locations are part of literary works and how that especially over time changes. So that's the agenda for what we're going to present on. A little bit about our activities, very shortly, just so you can see how we have worked. We have had yearly seminars at UCLA and at Aarhus twice at UCLA. We have been making presentation at the DH Nordic conferences, which is also a fairly new series of digital humanities conferences in the Nordic region. We have been developing corpora of Scandinavian texts and notebooks for other people to work with. We have made prototypes of genre classifiers and a corpora dashboard, which also included the results of the sentiment analysis that Christopher has made. And then you can also say that an important part has been to provide project support for other related projects. So this has been a very rather broad group of people where we have supported other projects that worked on these issues. And some of the people involved from Denmark, I won't list them all here, but from different universities in Denmark, from Sweden, from the University of Gothenburg, which is also the host of the Litteraturbanken, the literature storage in Sweden, Mads Malm and Cecilia Linhé. And in Norway at the University of Oslo, where Ellen Rees, who's a vice dean of research, also has a group that works on the amazing Norwegian collection of scanned books, where the Norwegian state has scanned most of the literary heritage in Norway. And finally, and that's of course part of the purpose of the Mellon Foundation, is to provide the transatlantic cooperation. And we've been so fortunate that a number of people have been there all the way. So I guess that means that they liked what they had the opportunity to do. So apart from Tim from UCLA, Peter Broadwell also from UCLA, Peter Leonard from Yale, Matthew Wilkins from Notre Dame, David Mimner from Cornell, and Dennis Tennant from Columbia University has participated in all our joint meetings. What has come out of this are some lasting cooperation. And again, I would just emphasize how valuable this has been in order to establish a Danish network for digital literary studies, where we got funding from the Danish state or for the Danish Independent Research Fund, which gave us 150,000 euros to work for the next 2.5 years to work in the track that we have laid out here with this project. There are externally funded projects that have benefited also from the environment and being able to reference this. So for example, Ellen Rees' group in Norway and Jakob Ladegaard, who has a project on heritage, studying that from 1600 to contemporary times, has also been taking part of this project. And at Aarhus University, we right now have a 40 faculty digital literacy course where people have individual projects, and that is supported by people like Tim and Peter Leonard and Christopher, who has also got to know each other and learned how to work together through this project. And finally, this has resulted in guest professorships. Dennis Tennan will visit Aarhus early next year, and Matthew Wilkins will be at Aarhus University next fall. So a lot of things that sort of started with this, but certainly not ended. So for that, we have appreciated that a lot. Now, onto things we have done and which are more tangible. I call it a head start. This is a volume that came out a year and a half ago, Danish Literature as World Literature, which was edited by me and my colleague, Professor Dan Ringgaard from the Scandinavian Department at Aarhus University. And it's part of a larger series, As World Literature. It's a series at Bloomsbury, which I'm also on the editorial board of. What we did there was, well, as we in the subtitle of our project, to combine qualitative and quantitative approaches. We have 10 chapters in the book, which is all fairly canonical. We take up some of the most recognized Danish authors and build histories around those that emphasizes what are the relations to the world around. Who were they influenced by, and what kind of influence have they exerted on literature in general? And some of them are extremely well known, Hans Christian Andersen, for example. Others are less known, like Jens Peter Jacobsen and Herman Bang, who are mostly famous in Germany. Sometimes we think they're world literature in Denmark, but it's more like a German-Italian thing, and more lately also in English translation. And 20th century figures like Isaac Dinesen, Karen Blixen, who was made famous by Out of Africa, by Sidney Pollack and other movies. And for that we have sort of what I think was an all-star lineup of Danish professors with deep knowledge on these authors. What the deep knowledge did not include was, I mean, how do they actually measure? What is their impression of the influence of these writers? How do you think about that? And to help them qualify that in ways I think is recognizable in the way they eventually wrote their chapters. We had a report made by a now graduate student, Julia Kjær Markussen, under the direction of me in particular, and later on Christopher, where she explored all the sources that normally wouldn't be used, and some hadn't occurred yet at the time where literary sociology was founded, namely social media influences, but also translation databases, sales figures as far as you can get it, library holdings, but as well as all kinds of sources that we can find in Facebook, Goodreads, and different other social media. And what she compiled there was a very interesting, illuminating report, also with a comparative perspective, trying to find the most similar author that, from an international perspective, that could be compared to these authors. Some of the findings, I mean, were interesting in the routes that these authors had into the world, the degree of how they measure up with other writers. And sometimes you would be impressed from a sort of nationalistic Danish viewpoint and say, wow, Hans Christian Andersen is really, really famous. And other times you would get the narrative that, okay, so this may not be as famous as we thought it was. Or you get debunked that the whole idea of a Nordic crime fiction boom is more a Norwegian and in particular a Swedish crime fiction boom, whereas the Danish contribution to that is not as outstanding, whereas on the other hand what we have done with film in the past couple of decades is a different and more positive story. And to make sure that this was not just a report, we also had a two-day seminar, not just focused on the report, but going through all of the chapters, having Tim come over from UCLA. We also had Hans-Ole Gumbrich from Stanford University come in. And what it gave, I think, was really this deeper understanding of influences, and based on a variety of different sources that normally, when people who have been working for a long time in this field, they wouldn't have been consulting that. But I think their articles and the output was made better by having this resource, which, again, not to belittle what a graduate student costs, but at a modest cost in money, we were able to make this product. And of course, these are not definitive results as such, where you could say, well, now we have cracked the code of figuring out an exact science of influences. That's not the point. The point is that we have a much more solid foundation of addressing these issues than had we just relied on our intuitions. So for that was one sort of promising start to what we did. But then we went on to do things that we thought would be more complicated and may not have been resolved yet, but we have taken steps.
Thank you. Where to start, actually? Well, I guess that from the beginning we were quite interested in sort of not so much developing software as hacking other people's software and hacking databases to get data. In our study of sort of how literature impacts the world and how the world impact or how the world is impacts literature. So how did we go about? Well, with that, well, essentially we thought hackathons. That's basically what we want to do. We arranged hackathons, many hackathons, where we brought together all kinds of researchers from US, from Scandinavia, and gave them either identify research questions or gave them research they had or gave them research questions, and then we simply hacked away for a couple of days. But to do this, we needed sort of a basic data resource. So we went through what was available in Danish or Scandinavian databases over Scandinavian literature, and most of them don't have an API, so essentially we have to crawl everything. But all right, we did that, and we essentially built a... So what is you really need when you want to do hackathons? You need a repository. A repository that we can share the data in, we can share the code, and so on and so forth. So we established CLEAR, which is essentially sort of a computational or a repository for computational literary analysis. And it contains all the data that we collected, in basically flat files, but we also have markup in some cases. It's freely available on GitHub. Not very long though, we're moving to a local GitLab server after Microsoft's takeover of GitHub, but that's a different story. We are sharing everything here. We accumulated a lot of code, so not really software. It's just sort of us stealing other people's code, putting it together, forcing it to do what we wanted it to do on Scandinavian literature. And then slowly, as this evolved, we actually had some of my research assistants. They would simply offer to develop a tool or sort of a or recreate a tool essentially for researchers if they needed one at these hackathons. Now, as it evolved, it also started to become an educational resource, because now slowly as we sort of accumulated code and had a lot of data, we could actually offer this for any sort of course where you wanted to start to develop sort of a digital or computational literacy in literary studies. Freely. So this is in a way our mode of approaching the problem was, you know, it was through hackathons essentially. Now, to that's actually the previous project also mentioned issues of normalization. So that's really a thing you have to deal with when you're working with low variant resources like Danish, historical Danish. it's not standardized from the 17th, 18th century. It's terrible. I mean, from a computational perspective, it's terrible. You have the single author spelling the same word in 10 to 15 different ways through their career. So all this orthographic variation, for instance, how are we really to deal with this? Because we wanted to use tools that were essentially developed for contemporary language in Denmark, basically newspapers from the 50s and onwards, right, and a bit of social media. So our strategy, instead of, so many people, what they essentially choose is they adapt the tool to the language that doesn't scale very well because of the variation I just mentioned. So instead, we normalized text. We essentially forced H.C. Anderson to write like 2010 Facebook user or something like that to caricature the problem a little bit. But essentially that's what we did. We made a freely available spelling corrector that would modernize Scandinavian languages. And it's actually, it's a statistical spelling corrector, but we then had help from a group of corpus linguists for introducing a lot of rules also. So it's sort of rule-based statistical spelling corrector for modernizing. This is just one of the challenges we've had to fight working with Scandinavian literature. So a couple of examples of what we actually did. So remember, we were interested in how literature was impacted by the world, but also how the world was impacted by literature, essentially. So one thing that we looked on was starting to investigate changes in literature. So in this case, we looked at middle-aged text, Saxo Grammaticus, which is sort of an old historian's source that essentially from the 12th century, correct, right? Okay, so where essentially the issue here is that it essentially invents the historical genre in Denmark, in Scandinavia. So part of it is essentially sort of a sort of literary approach to retelling the story of the Danes. Another part of it is sort of more sort of a historical genre. And we really wanted to figure out, when does this change happen? So this is highly debated in studies of Gesta Danorum, which is the work consists of 16 books. So we essentially developed different techniques based on, so there was a bit of discussion here about tracking topical structure and sort of, so what we essentially did was adapting certain sort of signal processing techniques for detecting changes, and that's essentially what you see up there. You see two sort of dark squares, which signifies two different genres embedded in these 16 books, one being the sort of more literary, fictive retelling of the Danish story, almost mythical, and the other part being sort of a more historical registering tradition, which actually reflects. So what's interesting is that the historical genre is born or coincides with the narrative of how Denmark became Christian. So the mythical part is when we were Norse or heathen. And so this was essentially a signal processing approach to solving a problem related to how the external world impacts on literature. This evolved into, all these projects are from hackathons. They essentially developed in 2 or 3 days. And they result in papers, but I mean, they essentially just, you know, bringing people together, having them work on this. So another project we worked on was, so for quite a while, and this is the dynamic sentiment analysis that Mats mentioned. Essentially, we, approximately 2 years ago, these story arcs were very popular, so ways of summarizing the plot of a narrative, essentially. They were quite popular for different reasons in natural language processing, at least. And they're all right. You can sort of capture the basic plot vector, you could describe it as, of a narrative. But we were not really satisfied with those results. Sort of you could say, okay, this is a tragedy, or this is a comedy, and so on and so forth. You could describe work of that. Not really so surprising. But you could at least confirm some basic assumption in literary studies. But we started then developing ways of measuring persistence in these vectors. So essentially taking these story arcs, extracting particular features, that's essentially what you're seeing over there, where we are seeing, we're looking at how persistent is a particular sort of, think of this as a theme or as a, as an, um, as a, an emotion or something in the narrative. And what we can actually predict with this is the reader's response to where the plot changes, just on when the persistence in these plot vectors changes. So basically the minima here represents larger changes in the plot of an entire novel. So this is an English novel where we're illustrating this, but I mean, and this scales, by the way. It scales because we rewrote code for making it scale, and this is what we can show here, because this is essentially this is a measure of the coherence of a text or the persistence of particular topics in the text or semantic aspects. And what we then started wondering about was, well, can this be used to characterize a good narrative or a good plot, something that you would like? Because if we are close to predicting this sort of development or how it will be experienced by reader, then we might actually use it to describe so to assess the quality of a plot, you might argue. So without too much explanation here, essentially it's just that that 0.5 on this, so the middle of this distribution, interestingly enough, essentially is sort of no real coherence in a narrative. So if you look, and this is what we've done here, on 10 or maybe actually 12,000 Danish works of literature from the 19th century, you'll see that the vast majority really are not that interesting, which is not that surprising. But if you start looking at particular authors, H.C. Andersen, for instance, you will see that the coherence of all his narratives are actually remarkably higher. So he's lying in sort of the upper or the, for you, the right tail of this distribution, which is highly unlikely that all his works are lying up there. So what we have here is something that can actually be used to automatically assess the quality or the coherence of a work of art, and that we then expanded to actually being able to prepare this between languages using developing, well, in a way, sequence alignment, but in this case we are experimenting a little bit with different warping techniques, but it's essentially sequence aligning, in this case of the ugly duckling between Scandinavian languages. Yes.
And just let me say before I give the word to Tim, I mean, I think this is extremely interesting, also as a mode of evaluating large corpora of literature. And what we also did at one of the hackathons was to build a dashboard that also included this measure. So as a tool for saying, so I want to see how this text adds up in relation to a larger corpora of text, or give me the text that is within this spectrum of coherence, I think could be a very, very interesting thing. And also because it can be used comparatively, as you already suggested.
It's of course important to point out that we have benchmarked this on Nobel laureates, for instance, their literature, but it's of course important to point out that we are not arguing that the quality, for instance, of a successful novel is only in the novel. For, of course, also a context and so on and so forth. But we have identified a property or feature that seems to be positively correlated with the successful work of literature.
Yeah, so I think one of the things that we're often confronted with as humanities scholars is this problem of, you know, I'm interested in this, and things like this, but we really have a very poor vocabulary for telling you what I mean, what is like this. So a lot of what we've been trying to do is work, and I'm going to use the word scale in a different manner than we've been using it, but to work with the analysis of literature at many different scales of analysis. And so all the way down to the very closest philological engagement, even with the single word, but then moving out not only to, say, a literary tradition within one linguistic area, but broadening it to, for example, all of Scandinavia. And while many people from the outside think that Danish, Swedish, and Norwegian are pretty much the same language, they aren't. And that actually raises all sorts of horrible problems when you try to work with them. One of the most horrible problems we all encountered, I recall just sort of sitting around looking at each other thinking, oh my God, how are we going to deal with this problem of orthographic normalization, a problem that we confront constantly, not only in one language, but now if we try to broaden it across even just the three less inflected Scandinavian languages of Danish, Swedish, and Norwegian, if we throw in Icelandic and Faroese, all bets are off, partly because of their inflectional complexity, but also because, as we've mentioned, most of these are what you would call low-resource or extremely low-resource languages. And so this idea of trying to put together corpora, not only for research, but also for testing, is crucial to a lot of the work we've done. And so Mats was almost genius in bringing together all of these different groups of people who were already working on projects and trying to integrate these projects, and then bringing in people from different perspectives as well, to in part develop, I think, a series of pipelines. The way we are working is in many ways, what are the problems, what are the different steps that we're going to have to address to eventually address that. So one of the things I'm very interested in is, while Scandinavia has a shared literary history, and if we look at the late 19th century in Scandinavia, there were a lot of people who were eager to have sort of a shared Scandinavian model. There were still these barriers, and one of the questions is, how do we work across languages? How can we work across languages? And so we had been working on a couple of different projects that have the potential to work across languages, and now we're also working on another project that specifically is focused on multilingual query expansion, basically. So search in one language and get hits from other languages. So I'll very briefly talk about some of these different projects. The three that I'll mention here, and the one that you can, you know, buy me a glass of wine, and I'll tell you about. And there's some wines that I'd like to taste, so I'll tell you which wines, and depending on the wine, you will see how much you get out of me, is basically using zero-shot translation with dictionary backoff to develop methods for searching across these languages, and not only on unprocessed text, but also searching across the output from some of the other projects that we've been involved in, or to feed some of these zero-shot translations into something like subcorpus topic modeling. A lot of people work with topic modeling. I'm intrigued by it because what does it really mean? I think what we really want to do is say, I'm very interested in Ham and Bang. And if you don't know it, maybe you are actually interested in Ham and Bang. It's just latent. You haven't surfaced yet. But let's say I'm really interested in Ham and Bang. I want to find other Scandinavian authors who share some of his writing. So can I discover some topics that are particularly representative of Ham and Bang and work iteratively through different levels of topic modeling, and then come up with what I like to think of as a fishing net, and throw that into a sea of books that I've never read before, and pull that fishing net through those sea of books and find other passages that would be interesting to me because I'm interested in Ham and Bang. So I model Bang and I use that as a kind of a fishing net to find other chunks of text that are particularly Bang-like. This is something that I think is important in the humanities, because a lot of times when we train our graduate students, we train them in very precise search methods, right? You're going to study Melville. It's pretty easy. You just go and you find all of Melville. But what about things that are sort of precursors to Melville or antecedents to Melville? How do you go about finding those? It used to be we'd go to conferences, would talk to people and say, oh, have you read, you know, so-and-so? He said, well, as a graduate student, you say, oh, yes, of course I have. Maybe older, you're like, yeah, no, I've never heard of him. And then you go back and you find that person. That's not very efficient. So one of the goals here was to develop a tool that was relatively efficient. So using a probabilistic model, can I discover the topics? Can I use these topics to find other texts? And the challenge here in Scandinavia is, can I model a writer in Danish And find Swedish and Norwegian writers who are writing that way as well. And so those are some experiments that we're playing with right now, and that involves these sort of neural model translation with some little finesses to it. But we did come up with a nice little interface here, which is the Scandinavian, the subcorpus topic modeling thing, where you can upload any corpus that you would like, label it, model it, and you can model it at multiple levels. One of the things I've found a little bit, I don't know, tedious is perhaps going to talks where people said, well, we then modeled, we did a latent Dirichlet allocation topic model over the corpus, and here's what we came up with. And then if you ask them how they chose how many topics were in their corpus, that's the question that nobody really can answer. There's no way really to optimize that, and there shouldn't be. What I would really like, because this is something that you think with, is to be able to model it at multiple levels. And for each one of those levels, you find some topics. Some of them will be junk, and so you turn them off. So we've developed this sort of topic curation system. You can turn on and off these topics. You can label them yourself. We're working on developing a system so that you can share those topics once you've created them. And then other people can supply their own labels. And then you can go through and either just use that as a way to understand the corpus that you're working with, or you can use it as a form of creating this fishing net. And then once you have that subcorpus model, you can then infer those topics on any arbitrary collection of texts. And so that gives you this topic modeling as search engine, as opposed to topic modeling as some high-level abstract representation of the topic. So we have frequent words that you can see. You've got user labeling. You can see the chunks of the text that have this topic. And then when you, you'll see when we go into the actual topic itself, you can see how that, or the actual chunk of text, you can see how those topics play out. One of the things we discovered was that n-grams, high-frequency n-grams, were much better representation, much better for you to think with when you're thinking about labeling topics. So we present a little top phrases. It turns out that 2 grams and 3 grams are much more common, and so they kind of rise to the top. But that helps people in their labeling. So the whole idea is to get people to start thinking about this. And then I can't read that because my eyes are so bad. Oh, there's a recommender system. If you like this chunk of text, you'll probably like these chunks of text. And then there's just this list. And then you can also graph it. So I got my slides mixed up. So there's the graph. It shows you the topics that are associated with chunks. So it's a bimodal network here. And you can actually export that for Gephi. So you could do any type of analysis on the graph once you have chunks and topics. So you've got a bimodal network there. And then you can actually see, for any article, you can see the makeup of topics at that level, and you can choose which level you want to be looking at there. I think we're looking at 25 topics, but you could clip down to 50 topics. Here we're seeing a topic that's called love, and if you were to click on love, you would go and you would find all of the other chunks associated with love. So this is kind of a way of using LDA in an iterative manner that gives you more and more information over the corpus that you're working with. So you can decide what your corpus is or what your subcorpus is, and then you can point it at any larger corpus to find other texts. And so the next step behind this is to do these zero-shot pairwise translations between Danish, Swedish, and Norwegian, which turn out in our testing to be unusually accurate. And so once we can do that, you should be able to search for kærlighed, or whatever label you've given the love topic, and pull up texts from the Danish, the Swedish, and Norwegian. So those are the experiments we're running right now on that. The other thing that we wanted to do was, can we interrogate pre-existing classifications? So a lot of times we'll find that there are schools of work, or there are groups of authors, or there's a period, or a moment. And can we surface that period without telling the machine that that is a period? Or would the machine classification give us a different periodicity? So one of the challenges in literary history is this question of periodicity. Who's deciding what those periods are? Are we missing something at the edges, or have we been a little bit too capacious in saying all of this is the modern breakthrough? So in some ways, it's kind of a distant text similarity analysis. So we take a corpus. Here we're using our DS Clear, our DL Danish Literature Clear corpus. And we try to compare every text to every other text. And one of the things that we find, not terribly surprisingly, is that most texts are incredibly similar to themselves. And so that's that very strong diagonal there. But you also see this bleed over where you're starting to get these kind of box-like patterns, which means that there are certain texts that are not the same text, but have some high similarity measure. And one of the questions we had was, is this the modern breakthrough? Many of you probably recall from elementary school or your primary class, primary school education, the modern breakthrough in Scandinavia. I'm sure they did a whole 6 or 7 months on it. And so then the question is, where is the modern breakthrough in a graph like this of Danish literature? And the question is, can we discover it? Does the machine discover it? Or does it confuse us? And so we use these confusion matrices a lot to try and understand where there's overlap. Once we find the modern breakthrough, one of the questions we had was, how similar are these authors to each other? And it turns out not very, if we're looking just at the top-ranked documents. So here we're simply returning the highest-ranked documents for any authorship with its similarity ranking. But since we've got a rank list, we can actually be more expansive and relax those standards and look for second, third, fourth rank documents, and that becomes a little bit interesting. But in keeping with a lot of what other people have been talking about, is we also wanted to be able to get back to the underlying texts. So we developed this visual representation of here, you know, a text on the top, Niels Lune by E.P. Jacobsen, and the words that are most highly associated with that, and then Pontoppidan's Lykkepær, which is actually, for a literary historical perspective, Lykkepær and Niels Lune do not immediately jump to mind as a comparison, but in this confusion matrix, particularly when we relax the parameters and not only look at first rank hits, we start to find these overlaps between authorships that we weren't, you know, that normal canonical literary history would not expect you to find. And so because we've got this drill down, we can actually go in and start to explore what is it that's generating the similarity at the level of a document, and here really at the level of paragraphs, because that's one of the ways we've chunked. It's not that interesting when you see, you know, self-similarity, except that Pontoppidan is really only much like Pontoppidan, whereas some of our other, when we relax the parameters, start to overlap with each other a lot more. One of the interesting things that we're now exploring, we're loading more authors into this, is that the female authors of Moderne Gennembruch, of the modern breakthrough, are actually much more similar to other female authors of the modern breakthrough. And then we also have these small clusters of male modern breakthrough authors who are very similar to each other. But there doesn't seem to be that much crossover. And that's actually an interesting thing to interrogate. We knew that there were a lot of women writing during the Martin breakthrough, but perhaps it's going to give us a more nuanced perspective on really what is probably the most important literary moment in 19th and 20th century Scandinavian literature. And by expanding this over Sweden and Norway as well, I apologize, I'm taking a very Dano-centric perspective here. By expanding it over all of Scandinavia, the chances for finding more of these types of overlaps are good, and that's what we're really interested in, is expanding our recall over what has in the past been fairly precise and almost canonical approaches. not to sound like a broken record, but we've also been doing some fuzzy text reuse mapping. Can we find examples of language reuse across this multilingual corpus? Is really what we've been particularly interested in. I'm a folklorist, and a folklorist, we're studying thousands of variants of the same story. And so we're actually working with the Swedes and the Norwegians on a project that has a little over a million stories, and we're interested because of the way these stories are recorded, what kinds of reuse that we can actually find. So again, using a confusion matrix, we are looking for things that are actually off the diagonal, because on the diagonal you just have the text compared to itself. And we find these very interesting patterns that we can zoom in on, and it'll give us the different texts that have a high match on the reuse, particularly when we start to zoom in off the diagonal. We find these very interesting thread-like patterns, which we can then select and put into kind of a rank list, and that allows us to find the actual strings that are not identical, but they're sort of the semantics of them are identical. They're conveying the same thought, but even though the words are not exactly the same. So for us, that's a very powerful tool. We're using a different approach. We're using a locality-sensitive hashing algorithm, MinHash, and then we have a 14-word window that we move. We've been incrementing it three words or three tokens at a time, and that also seems to work well. And then finally, I mentioned this multilingual query expansion. Again, the challenges of orthography, which we're addressing through through the tools that we've developed through CLEAR. The challenges of word use. I have a very funny story that's vaguely obscene about word use in Danish and Norwegian, and it goes back to my ill-spent youth going to rock festivals across Scandinavia, and we were having some beers before the Roskilde festival was kicking off that evening, and we had met some Norwegians, and they wanted to know if we wanted to get together for some forspiel before the concert. In Danish, that actually means foreplay, and in Norwegian, it just means the party before the party. So there's a good example of challenges of word use. So we're going to have these kinds of semantic distance between the two. The goal is really to search in one Nordic language and find the results in all of the other Nordic languages, and then recognize that they're domain-specific words, so we have ideally a very small list of domain-specific words over some corpus where we can do kind of dictionary back-off. We're still trying to figure out how to do this best, but we can do full-text search on indexed dirty translations, and here we implement this zero-shot translation approach that is basically a neural model translation system, which gives us a little bit better than the other PB phrase-based translation. So those are things that we're just working on. We want to, you know, continue working on the orthographic normalizer in sort of understanding that better. And we want to, you know, develop larger corpora, which is integrating the Norwegian Bokhylla. We've been working a lot with Mats Malm at the Svensk Litteraturbank. And then, of course, we have very good connections with Dansk Sprog og Litteraturselskab and access to their works. Whenever we work in Scandinavian languages, we keep bumping up against interesting issues of intellectual property rights and copyright protection, and those aren't going to go away, so we have to figure out strategies for dealing with them.
Okay. Then finally, as I mentioned, Matthew Wilkins of Notre Dame has been part of the project, and about the same time that we wrote an application, he also wrote an application for the Textual Geographies project, which is still working, and I'm part of the group behind it. All credit goes to Matt for what they have accomplished, and which is essentially geotagging 10 million books from the HathiTrust repository and make it searchable, and also being able to define searches in different ways. Matt will be working with us at Aarhus next year, but as a sort of a preamble to that, we try to figure out, I mean, what can we learn about how the world sees the Nordic? What is the geographical interest in the Nordic? So this is a preliminary study. I'll show you four slides, and then we're done with our presentation. Done by Matthew Wilkins, a Megan Kulitz, a graduate student, and myself. And as I said, this is a large corpora. This is mainly based on English books in American and in UK. And one of the most significant findings we found, and I'll show you in some graphs, is how the interest in the Nordic region dropped sharply, particularly from the US in the 1890s, and how it rebounds in the 1930s. And there's some other very interesting things that you could say. You can know that if you don't approach it this way. So first of all, this is how the corpus that Matthew selected from the larger HathiTrust corpus, based simply on a geographical region. I mean, is there any location, just one, in these texts that points to an entity from the Nordic region? And as you can see, there is this strong dip in the 1920s, and then a rise again. And what is interesting is that there is a drop, in particular also in a broad interest, that there are fewer works that have just a single representation, but those that do have representation of the Nordic region, they have more of them. They're more elaborate. And what is interesting, where does this loss of interest come from? And the short story is that it comes from the US. Whereas the Great Britain or UK, or books that can be identified as belonging to the UK, they keep a fairly constant interest in the Nordic region. The US loses interest, and we try to then come up with ways of thinking about how can that be. And we don't have conclusions of that yet, but I think if we go into the works, one of the reasons would be that the number of immigrants to the US who writes about their home country or the home region, that they sort of stop writing, or they're not in the same numbers. And that could be one of the reasons why there's a shift in the US interest in the Nordic region. A couple of different findings, but which is also, I think, pretty interesting in terms of, so what does it tell about how a location or a region is approached by us, is how the detail of location changes. And the finding is that, you can see the curve here, shows that there are more and more the proportion of references to subnational references increases. That it's not just Sweden or Denmark or Norway, but it's maybe Aarhus or Copenhagen or Oslo, or even more place-specific names that people refer to. So there's a clear trend in the way that you have more detailed observations about or way of writing about this. Something with Matthew Wilkins has also explored on London, how that differs, how a UK and a expressionist perspective on writing about London also differs very much. And maybe not surprisingly, it also shows up that books written in the United Kingdom, they tend to be more specific. That's where, and you could say it's not surprising, but if you don't know how to show it, how do you actually know it? And this shows that some of the more specific ways of referring to not just Scandinavia or the Nordic and so on, but to Zealand, for example, that is much more pronounced in UK writers. They have a different intimacy of the region, a different way of approaching that. And the only places where the UK US writers stand out is, for example, on Greenland, where you have the proximity to the American continent. So again, these are, as I said, these are some of the latest things we did in the project. We found it was important to also use this resource that Matt has developed and show how it can be used on a very specific issue of seeing how Scandinavia and the Nordic region interacts with the world. We'd love that there was a Danish or Swedish geotagging of all the resources. There's not, but you have to sort of build the ship with the components that are available. And I think we have come a long way. And as I said in the beginning, there are lots of things that doesn't stop with this, and we'll continue to go on. But for now, we would like to thank you for your support.